This story is called Paper. It's read and authored by me, Dawn Feligund. I wrote this story back in 2005 for my friend Feng Geranium's birthday. She had requested, as I recall, a story about Curafin, who was a character I hadn't written a lot of, because to that point I had really worked a lot in my verse for Another Man's Cage, or AMC, and Curafin, of course, was not born yet at that point, so this was a new direction for me, a new character to explore. He was a character that had not really ever appealed to me very much, so it was kind of fun to take this in a new direction. It was really the first time I felt he spoke to me as a character. Also, it was one of the first times I had attempted short fiction based on the Silmarillion. Up until that point, I had really committed myself to writing long stuff. I couldn't see myself writing anything short, but a birthday present can't really be a novel every time, so Paper was born out of that, out of writing a story about Curafin and a short story for my friend Feng Geranium. So again, this is Paper, read and authored by Dawn Feligund. Stepping through the gates and onto the road to Tirion, Curafinway, the fifth son of Feanaro, feels relief, like shedding a set of too tight clothes. Air cools his lungs like he's been smothering all this time, pent up inside his father's house. His very skin seems to expand. He feels larger here than he does at home, in the presence of his brothers and, of course, Feanaro. It was Feanaro who'd sent him on this mission, thus granting him freedom. Purchase more parchment, such a simple task, but so tedious to the others. Who wouldn't wish to be called away from work or leisure to take a half day for something so ordinary? But Curafinway loves the parchment shop, and his feet are light upon the path. He has to restrain himself from running, fearing that if he leaps too high in his mirth, he might dangle among Varda's stars and never be recovered. He'd be beyond even the reach of Feanaro, then. Paper, so delicate and easily torn, ephemeral almost, disintegrating over the centuries, the inscriptions upon its surface wearing away with the years, so easy to destroy, to burn. Yet Curafinway presses a sheet of it to his face when the shopkeeper is not looking, and he inhales the dry, dusty smell, so bland, as though asking to be overtaken by something else. This close, he can see the individual fibers that make it whole, and he smiles, wishing to write an ode to each, so easily overlooked. But without a single one of them, there would be a hole, and the paper would be worthless. There is a tiny blue thread squirming among the rest, possibly from the shopkeeper's robes, Curafinway surmises, glancing over the top of the paper at the man who is, indeed, wearing blue. And he smiles to think that the paper already tells a story, but before it even soaks up the words that he will place upon it, his story. And so the paper itself is a lore master, he thinks, like me. Each story containing a story within and without, spiraling toward infinity in both directions. Only his lore has never happened, and likely will not. Hopefully will not, he forces himself to add, knowing the wickedness of the words that he has committed to paper in times past, at times burning the paper in lieu of burning himself, who is certainly more deserving. As though knowing and protesting the fate of its predecessors, the paper nicks his finger, a hairline cut that oozes blood. Curafinway pops it into his mouth before it can mar the paper. No, this page will bear a story that has nothing to do with pain. Feanaro never denied his young namesake all of the paper he could desire. Even as an infant, charcoal stick clutched in his fist, Curafinway wrote and drew, or rather, attempted to write and draw, raking the paper in his frustration, tearing it and leaving charcoal marks upon the floor to be dimpled by his dripping tears. His tangwar were wriggling snakes. His attempt to draw his father yielded nothing but a worm-eaten apple upon a crooked pole. But the drawings were carefully repaired by his father and hung in the laboratory, overtaking the sheet music from Macalari's acclaimed ballad first, then the awkward sketches done by Tile Cormo and Carnastir for one or another of their father's assignments, and finally, even my Timos treatise on the structure of metallic elements that had been the subject of much discussion all the way to the Halls of Alai. Feanaro acquainted Curafinway with the Tangwar much younger than he had his other sons, even my Timel. They would sit together in the heavy golden light of afternoons, Curafinway upon his father's lap, and his small hand in Feanaro's much larger one, and, within that, the quill. And Feanaro would guide Curafinway's hands through the proper strokes. He marveled at how much more beautiful his letters were with his father's guidance. Not a single wobble, not a single stroke missed or done in reverse. He would close his eyes and fall asleep to the sound of his father's voice and the warm comfort of his embrace. When he awakened, there was sheet after sheet of Tangwar in front of him, and awed, Curafinway began to believe that this was the stuff of dreams. They were fated to meet, the children of Feanara's thought and the child of his body, the Tengwar and Cura Finwë. Sometimes, Cura Finwë believed that he liked his brothers in thought more than his brothers in blood. Jeering words could be struck through, but when he raised his hands to Carnesteer for the first time, he awoke minutes later with a buzzing numbness in his head that flourished into pain in the same way that a quill, left carelessly upon a page, will spread its stain. There was fear in both Carnesteer's and Tile Cormo's eyes when Cura Finwë first awoke, as though they believed Carnesteer had killed their little brother. But that quickly hardened into something malignant when they saw that he was nothing more than bruised, and Tile Cormo swore to tell their father that Cura Finwë had fallen if he dared tell of Carnesteer's actions. "And you shall know your first taste of Atar's wrath," Tile Cormo said, and Carnesteer laughed and said, "It is bitter too, little brother, and lingers across decades." And so, throat thick with tears, Cura Finwë turned to his brothers in thought for consolation. To them, he told the truth, and they believed him, and together they constructed beautiful retribution. Carnesteer, eyes glowing like a fiend, drove his fist into Cura Finwë's head, and they both laughed, and the sound was like thunder. They didn't see their father watching, but Feanara, son of Finwë, saw all. His wrath was awful. He drove Tile Cormo and Carnesteer into the night. He renounced them as his sons. "You are no blood of mine," he said. He told them that he hated them for what they had done to Cura Finwë. And he hugged Cura Finwë and promised to never, never let such a thing happen again. And Cura Finwë couldn't cry, not in Feanara's arms. His tears burned away before they even existed. The marks on the paper were vicious gashes in ink, certainly not the meandering, graceful characters that his father had created, reminiscent of the wind and the waves of the sea. His tears plunked onto the paper and smudged the ink. It was barely legible, but he knew the weight of what he had written, comprehensible to others or not. He stole Feanara's flints and burned the paper. The smoke stung his eyes and coaxed tears from him. If he leaned over it and let it burn his eyes, that didn't change the reason for his tears. The fire drew his parents to him, and Feanara was angry, but for the fire, not the words. His brothers treat him differently than they do each other. Cura Finwë can't help it. He didn't ask to be given the same name as his father. Even Maitamo, who is the only of his brothers whom Cura Finwë truly likes, laughs less freely in Cura Finwë's presence. There is a minute tightening of Maitamo's body. Shoulders stiffen, knees come together, and hands wrangle each other in his lap. He gives tiny, wincing smiles that make Cura Finwë wonder if someone is jabbing Maitamo in the back with a pin. Recently married, Makalari pays little heed to Cura Finwë. He barely glances from his wife's face to even give a greeting, and if Fingarié is not present, then he speaks to Maitamo. The two are rarely apart. Tile Cormo and Carnesteer drift perpetually on the periphery of Cura Finwë's life, two satellites whose orbits occasionally intersect and exert a greater-than-usual influence on their younger brother. They are masters in subtle cruelty and wide-eyed innocence. Once they waited for Cura Finwë to leave the library for a drink of water and rearranged all of his books and papers, negating the hours of work he'd done to arrange his desk appropriately. He went to Nerdanel, but Tile Cormo and Carnesteer appeared then with leaves in their hair and the smell of fresh winds about them, supposedly back from a hunting trip, and Nerdanel was fooled, not seeing the glint of mischief in their eyes. "Aw, poor Atarintke," Tile Cormo said, drawing his tearful little brother into an embrace, but Cura Finwë ripped himself away and fled to the library, while Tile Cormo lamented to their mother, "I try to be his friend." And so Cura Finwë had no one but Feanara, and the self-fulfilling prophecy came to fruition. Feanara gave to his youngest son the task of copying all his letters before they were sent, so that he might keep copies in his own records. Feanaro's script meandered with the fickleness and grace of the wind, letters devolving into superfluous flourishes, promenading across the page. He was recognized as the best calligrapher of the Noldor, and despite his superior station as the eldest son of the king, the lords commissioned him to scribe the invitations for their important events. Maitamo was also excellent at lettering, but his was proper and controlled, and looked like a sample from a textbook. "It is useless," he said of their father's excess once, in a rare show of defiance, and Feanara replied, "You find beauty to be useless?" "I do not," Cura Finwë, omnipresent in his father's study to the point of invisibility, interrupted. Maitamo tensed and looked away. Cura Finwë labored over the letters, always feeling a pinch of fear when he first held a loaded quill over an unmarred parchment, trying to mimic his father's beautiful style. He copied orders for marble and iron ore as he might copy a masterpiece painting, bent over the page, tongue poking between his lips, quill clenched so tightly in his fingers that they ached. At your earliest convenience, I should require 300 pearls for use in a chandelier to be given to Olwe, the king, for his wedding anniversary. The pearls may be a varied size, although I prefer a uniform, rounded shape. When Maitamo's treatise on metals came under discussion and debate, Feanaro penned a letter to Cura Finway's uncle, Nola Finway and Tyrion. To please their father, the brothers had begun a regular correspondence, the acidity of their words now cleverly concealed beneath overwrought prose and swirling Tengar. Cura Finway copied the letter dutifully and sent the original, but a second copy he made, a wicked copy, with some of the names changed, and with which he slept, pressed beneath his pillow, at night. My dearest Nola Finway, as you have surely heard, ensconced as you are in the heart of our throbbing, noisy civilization, my son, Cura Finway, has met with the greatest of honors for his recent labors concerning the patterns exhibited by various metals in their raw, elemental state. Indeed, it seems that Cura Finway's prodigy is being discussed in as high of places as the halls of Alae, and his work is being heralded as one of the most valuable contributions to the field of metallurgy. I am sure that I do not need to describe to you the thrill of pride one feels for his child's accomplishments, as I should hope that Findacano and Turricano have given you reason to indulge in the pleasure of such unrestrained pride, as it is not meritorious when it pertains to one's own son. Indeed, to think of myself as the artificer of one such as Cura Finway lessens the light of my other works, which until now have been my greatest accomplishments, yet I feel no regret to be so bereft. It is my fervent hope, Nola Finway, that such blessings shall also visit your house in the form of that granted me by my dear Cura Finway. Until then, I remain your most beloved half-brother, Cura Finway, Feanaro, Finwian. Feanaro had chosen Cura Finway's name, yet his brothers faulted him for it. He was not too young to perceive the agony in Maitamo's eyes when it was pronounced. I will call him Cura Finway. Of course, he also had Atarinke, but out of defiance of his brother's misguided resentment, when it came time to choose his name, he looked into Maitamo's eyes and said, I will be called Cura Finway. Maitamo flinched. Writing of it later, in the secret haven of the library, let it be known I have claimed my destiny as the favored son of Feanaro. And so the paper shop is a place full of potential for Cura Finway, ream after ream of paper, and what shall be written upon them? He selects the fine gilt-edged paper that Feanaro prefers, and then lingers in his own decision, ghosting each with his fingers, fearful of leaving a premature smudge. Normally, he is happy to lose hours in the selection, but today his heart patters with a renewed vigor, and his legs feel as though they possess coiled springs with the power to propel him, running, for leagues, if given the proper motivation. For at home, slip between the pages of a book on the physical properties of matter that he knows Tile Cormil and Carnesteer will never read, is the beginning of a new tale, this one of a different, more exciting sort. The sort that makes Cura Finway blush for no reason and select the same coarse-grained paper that he procured last time in his eagerness to get home. Tile Cormil and Carnesteer acted entirely differently when their sweethearts came to visit. Cura Finway would pass their bedrooms on his way from retrieving a new essay or a book from his chambers that he wished to show Feanaro, and pause to wonder at the ruckus emanating from behind his brother's closed doors. There seemed to be a good deal of scuffling and splashing and slamming of doors, punctuated by arguments of a most bizarre nature. You made me look like a girl. Your legs look like stilts in those shoes. Your backside hangs out of that tunic like a baboon. They would eventually emerge in their finest clothes, the likes of which they never wore otherwise, with their hair unusually neat and even smelling better than usual. Cura Finway paid them no heed except to wish fervently for their success with their sweethearts so that they might marry and move to Tyrion with Macalari and Maitamil. Cura Finway walked into the library once and was greeted with a frightened squeal and found Tile Cormo sprawled across the chaise with his current flame pinned beneath him. "Shh, it's just my brother," he said, and there was a flurry of scrambling hands and clothes being rearranged, and Tile Cormo looked pointedly at Cura Finway and hissed, "Get out!" And Cura Finway, terrified, had no thought but to do exactly as ordered, fleeing and not daring to stop until his level of exertion seemed a worthy reason for his pounding heart. He found himself sketching the girls his brother brought home, taking a perfect nose from one and adding it to the thick, chocolate-colored hair of the one who had dined beside Carnesteer the night prior. Sometimes he altered the features slightly, striving toward a vague vision in his mind, dancing constantly out of reach and into the undelved shadows. Frustrated, he sometimes captured the tip of an ear or a tendril of hair and cried out at the perfection of it, only to realize that the rest of the picture was unacceptably ordinary. when she was perfect, he knew, she would step from the parchment and into reality. His father called Kura Finway to his study once, in the midst of sketching, and he'd carelessly abandoned his work on his desk. At his return, he saw Carnassier standing over it, angling the latest drawing in his direction, wearing his dark, ugly hunting attire and a blank expression upon his face. Kura Finway ran and snatched the sketch from Carnassier's fingers, and Carnassier tossed his hands in a gesture of surrender. "No need for that! It's not a bad drawing!" But before Kura Finway could relax into his brother's rare benevolence, Carnassier's innocent expression twisted, and he added, "Except for the eyes. No woman has eyes that color, green eyes." He scoffed and trod from the room. That was the closest Kura Finway had come in his sketches, the thick chocolate-colored hair and delicate nose and high cheekbones and green eyes. He wrote of random encounters, meeting the green-eyed woman and knowing, in that instant, that he loved her, and seeing in her green eyes that she returned his love. He stepped into the street, dappled by afternoon light and shadow, and a voice asked behind him, "Would you like an apple?" He savored these tales, closing his eyes in the languid heat of afternoon, and allowing his books and studies to be forgotten, letting the quivering, strange feeling overtake him as he imagined taking the apple from her hands, the softness of her skin beneath his calloused fingers, while his quill bled, forgotten, onto the paper. She always had apples, apples the same brilliant green color as her eyes. The shopkeeper does not make conversation with the fifth son of Feonaro, knowing him to be not as gracious as Maitamil, or polite as Macalare, or as brashly loquacious as Tile Cormo and Carnassier. Kura Finway's fingers tremble as he fumbles the lampstones that were the agreed price between the shopkeeper and his father. Already, he imagines himself holding the quill and disappearing into the blissful emptiness of fantasy. Kura Finway takes his bundle in his arms and turns for the door. The afternoon light is seeping thickly through the door, and he cringes in anticipation of being blinded after the dusty dimness of the shop. He steps into the street and is not disappointed. The brilliance is almost painful. He blinks in Laurelin's radiance, shielding his eyes with his free arm, and so blinded on one side, collides with the maiden carrying the basket of apples. She kneels to retrieve them before they are trod upon, and stunned, his mouth dangles open in a silly and churlish manner as the paper slips from his arms and into the dust of the street, and his thundering heart drowns all reasonable thought. For a moment. Then, collecting himself, he kneels slowly, wishing desperately to see the color of her eyes beneath the spill of chocolate-colored hair. She smiles at him, lifting her head as he crouches beside her. Green. There, he ran out of paper.